Welcome to Stories After Midnight. Today we're going to be reading part 4 of a story submitted by Jarrett called Clean Slate. I hope you enjoy part 4 of this series, and let's get started. By the time Julie slipped under her covers, she'd been going nonstop all day and desperately needed sleep. The exhaustion settled into her bones the moment her head hit the pillow. The apartment was quiet. Outside, snow fell in thick, windless layers. She didn't know how long she'd been asleep before the knock came. It wasn't loud, just 3 soft taps. Julie was slowly lulled from her dream. Her eyes opened slowly, adjusting to the dark. She blinked up at the ceiling, heart already ticking faster. Another knock, then nothing. She sat up, covers rustling. The clock on her nightstand read 11:53. Her anxiety ratcheted up a notch as she examined the darkened corners of her bedroom. For a moment, she simply listened, ears straining. She was rewarded with nothing but the distant echo of a plow scraping through snow outside. Against her better judgment, she got up, her bare feet shocked as they made contact with the frigid wood floor. She pulled her robe snug around her body as she stepped carefully out into the hallway, her hand trailing along the wall for guidance. A pitch-black hallway stretched onwards to infinity, the kind of dark that gobbled up light and swallowed it. Her fingers found the living room doorway. She pushed through the threshold. The front door came into view at the end of the room then, glowing faintly from the hall light beyond it. But something was wrong. Her gut knotted as her anxiety gave way to true, unabashed fear. There were 2 dark shapes blocking the thin line of light that should have shone under the door. Someone was standing right outside her apartment. Julie froze, her breath caught in her throat. She didn't move, just watched the silhouette, not moving, not shifting weight, just waiting. Another knock, closer now, like whoever it was had leaned in. Julie backed up, retreating into the deeper shadows of the living room. She waited 30 seconds. A minute. Then the muffled sound of movement. A scuff. The shadow shifted. Footsteps retreated down the hall. Soft, measured, then gone. The living room clock struck midnight. Julie stood still for another 5 minutes before creeping toward the door, every floorboard threatening to give her away. She peered through the peephole. Empty hallway. Just a long strip of carpet and buzzing wall sconces. Her foot brushed something. She looked down. A small, square envelope was lying on her welcome rug. No markings, no name. Her fingers trembled as she opened it in the moonlight, pouring in from the window. A cliche she'd read in plenty of horror fiction before. But this, damn her, this was terrifying. It was about to get much, much worse. December 11th, 1969. Faye felt as if she'd stepped through the looking glass and wound up chatting with the Mad Hatter. She spoke in a calming, reassuring tone, trying desperately to alleviate the hysterical blather coming from Julie. It was a horrible hour for a call, but on a school night, Faye had to bite her tongue to keep from shouting at her sister. She had been stewing in unease ever since the phone call with Julie earlier that morning. What had gotten into her? Her ranting was nonsensical. Her paranoia had bothered Faye, but now it was something entirely different, about being woken up by a knock at the door and then getting an envelope pushed under the frame, and then she saw something. But what?
Julie, listen! I need you to slow down and tell me, slow down and tell me exactly what happened.
Okay. I saw something really bad, you know, and I'm terrified and I'm losing my mind and, oh, damn.
Julie, please, I'll call you an ambulance.
I don't need an ambulance.
The tone on the other end clipped from the scream. Faye held the receiver away from her ear reflexively, listening for the outburst to quiet down. When it did, Faye repeated,
"Just tell me as best as you can, sis. What happened, okay?"
A sniffle.
"Okay, so I opened the envelope. Okay, and then what happened? What was in it? A note. A note of what? You know, Henry Compton? No, who is... My coworker. He's dead.
Bay felt her heart skip.
What? What are you talking about? The note. What did it say? That he's dead. That they killed Melissa too. Oh, dear God.
Bay felt dizzy.
And on then it said, care to join them, Julie? And it had all my information on it. My name, address, social security number, bank account number, everything. Hell, even where I went to elementary school.
Faye thought Julie had gone mad. It reminded her of her ex-husband and why she divorced him.
Okay, Jules, listen to me. If what you said is true, it is.
Okay, okay. I believe you.
Call the police. Show them.
No,
they're in on it. They'll kill me.
Listen, call them. Let them help you.
They'll burn my house down.
Faye felt herself shift. Her concern was morphing more into annoyance, perhaps concern for Julie's well-being.
Okay, okay, Julie. What hospital did he stay at?
No, I can't tell you. They'll know you called.
Then tell me just in case, Jules. What if something happens to you? What if they come back to you? I need to know where you've been poking. I won't do anything, I promise.
Reluctantly, Julie told her. It took some more cajoling before she hung up. After the connection broke, Faye rose and referenced her phone book she kept in one of her kitchen drawers and found the number of the hospital. She dialed. After a receptionist answered, Faye asked,
yes, hi, I'm a friend of Henry Compton. Can I be connected to his room, please?
Some paper rustling, then the woman came back on the line.
I'm sorry. Henry Compton was transferred out less than 24 hours ago.
But he was alive? The receptionist laughed.
Oh, yes. In a coma, but stable. We don't transfer deceased patients.
Thank you. Faye set the receiver back down in the cradle and sighed. Julie was going off the deep end, and there was nothing she could do about it. Julie hadn't slept much, dozed off and on, but she'd tried to keep watch outside. The curtains were drawn, but she kept peeking through them, barely grasping the edge with one trembling finger. She watched the snow pile up in silent, powdery layers on the windowsill. She stumbled over to the couch and sat down with her knees hugging her chest. The envelope lay on the coffee table in front of her, untouched since she first read it. She couldn't bring herself to look at it again, but it kept playing over and over in her mind. Dear Julie Isley, if you keep staring, you'll see something you'd wished you hadn't. Henry Compton has expired, as is his wife, Melissa Compton. This is a very dangerous road you are traversing, Miss Isley. Proceed with caution. You don't know who we are, but we know everything concerning you. You take your coffee black, 2 cups by 9 a.m. You double-check your front door lock before heading to bed each night. You've begun to keep a steak knife beneath your pillow. It's dull. Replace it. You squint in low light. Consider glasses or contact lenses. You have a cracked molar you haven't told your dentist about. Your favorite blouse is the navy blue one with the white polka dots. You've worn it twice this week. You bite your thumbnail when typing. Right more than left. Stop it. It's a nervous tic. You sleep on your back to avoid neck pain. You complain to your coworkers about it. You buried a turtle behind the elm tree at 27 Oakwood Lane when you were 7. You never swim because you have a lifelong fear of drowning. You cried when your first grade teacher, Mrs. Talbot, switched classes. Your bank account ends in 8812. Your social security number ends in 2221. Your blood type is O negative. You haven't asked the right questions yet. She hadn't turned off the lights in the kitchen or the bathroom. She kept them all on, as if illumination might help keep death at bay. Every 5 or so minutes, or every time she heard a noise, she stood and tiptoed to the door, peering through the peephole.
The hallway beyond was unchanged. Brown carpet, dead silence. The overhead sconces buzzed like insects. She locked the door, then unlocked it, then locked it again. She'd pulled the chain taut, tested it, unhooked it, then tested it again, just to make sure it would hold in case of a home invasion. Paranoia felt like an inescapable dread. Like knowing the monster was under the bed, but you were sedated and couldn't do anything but watch it crawl out and smile at you. She moved to the kitchen, managing to pour the pitcher of water everywhere but the glass, and took a sip before spilling it down the front of herself, because her body was shaking too much to keep her stable. Her stomach turned inside out at the thought of ingesting anything else. The heater kicked on. She jumped so hard she yelped from surprise. The phone rang once earlier and she nearly had a heart attack. She hadn't answered and left it off the hook after that. By sunrise, she was crouched beside the window in her bedroom, watching the alley below, just snow and wind. But something in the shadows stirred, just for a second, and she flinched backwards, slamming her elbow against the wall hard enough to cause a radiating pain that shot up her arm and into her fingers. She cursed and rose to her feet, strolling back into the living room. Her typewriter sat unmoved, unused, worried that someone would break in and bash her head in while she slept. She heaved it up to place it back in the case and hide it, and dropped it anyway. The cast iron clanged against the floor, dinged once, then clattered to a stop. Julie's hand flew to her mouth, her eyes widening as she stared down at the table. "Dear Julie Isley, if you keep staring, you'll see something you shouldn't. If you think you're scared now, just wait." No, it was impossible. Another sheet. More letters. But these weren't polished letters. These were practice letters, slipped under her typewriter. The meaning was unmistakable. Julie gagged, retched, stumbled to the kitchen sink. She made it just in time to expel a deluge of clear, watery vomit down the garbage disposal. Practice notes. Whoever had written her the note had broken into her apartment, used her own typewriter, and written just feet away from where she slept. She didn't cry. She wasn't a crier. Now, she bawled. Julie sat in her car across the street from Leary Elementary, engine idling low, windows fogging faintly in the cold. She'd slept in her car in a public pay lot, safer than her apartment, she figured. At least she could get away in a split second if needed. Regardless, the bags beneath her eyes felt like weights sewn into her face, and her back and legs ached from being constrained to the car seat for hours. Despite this, she still felt alert, wired. Her coat was tossed into a ball in the passenger seat, her heater working overtime. A half-burnt cigarette drooped between her fingers, the ash spilling onto her lap unnoticed. She parked far enough from the school to avoid suspicion, but close enough to watch the rear exit. The staff lot. Fewer parents back here, fewer eyes. It was 2:35, and the last bell had rung 5 minutes ago. Kids began filling out the main entrance in chaotic little clusters, their laughter distant and muffled by the frosty windshield. She watched, time passed in lurching chunks. Her fingers twitched on the steering wheel, eyes darting toward every movement. Then she saw him, a small boy, dark hair, wearing a flimsy jacket, shivering in the cold, standing near the corner of the building with that same woman she'd seen chastise him the other day. He rubbed one arm, the frigid weather no doubt, and looked around like he was waiting for someone. Julie's breath caught it. It was him. It had to be David. She grabbed her documents from the passenger seat, flipped to the list. D.P. Leary. She didn't know his last name, but the initials, the age, the face, the way he looked at nothing, the way he waited. Her door handle twitched. She almost stepped out. Then she saw a flash of movement and saw it. A white van, no markings, painted over windows on either side. It pulled up behind the building, silent, efficient. Not fast, not slow, just purposeful. A gaggle of men stepped out. Not teachers, at least not any kind Julie recognized. They all wore long, pale coats, something official, medical maybe. Baker seemed to think so. Still, she didn't have a clipboard or any papers to jot down notes. But she had something better. A camera. Squinting through the viewfinder, she began snapping shots. The woman approached David and whispered something in his ear. He didn't resist. He looked at his feet and then followed. The back door of the van creaked open. Julie took more photos of the woman teacher, getting the faces of each of the lab coat men. A gallery of David being pulled into the van. A picture of the van's license plate. Julie's hand flew to her door handle again. She stopped. What would she even do? Charge across the street? Shout? The boy was yanked in before she could make any hasty decisions. The woman climbed in after him. The door shut. The van didn't burn rubber on the way out. It simply rolled forward, turned at the end of the lot, and disappeared down the block. Julie was still staring at the corner when she realized her nails had dug half moons into her palms. She couldn't move. And that's the end of this part. I really hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll stick around for the next part as well. If you are enjoying this series, let me know. If you're on YouTube, leave me a comment, or if you're listening on a podcast or whatever, well, let me know. I just appreciate hearing from you and knowing what you thought about it. A huge shout out to my patrons, too, for helping make this episode possible. I really appreciate you. And I don't really have anything to share. I mean, I guess you can find things in the description, but with all that said, thank you for hanging out with me. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next one.